finally coming back to Tony Leo, I'm going to make this point. The business community and the bankers have been having meetings, and they're talking, and the top political class, whoever that might be, are meeting with the business leaders and with the bankers and the government. So we could ask the question, where is the labor movement? Why isn't organized labor, who, by the way, what defines them, they don't own companies. So the people who don't own the companies but produce the wealth, they have things called unions. Why aren't the unions meeting? So, Tony Leo, are you there?
I am, Phil. Hi.
Well, you try to answer the question. Let's start with that one. What do you know about the response so far from what is called organized labor?
Well, I've seen a number of statements from different unions, but
you belong to Unifor, right?
Yes, I haven't seen a unified response, and the response from Unifor has been quite striking. The initial response from the leadership of Unifor was not to call for the labor movement to get together to work out the strategy for the working class to defend workers. In fact, Lana Payne, who's the president of Unifor, after Trump announced his plans to impose tariffs, told Unifor delegates this: "I have been burning up phone lines speaking with business leaders, CEOs, politicians about what we need to do."
Could you list the who she says she's been burning up lines to?
Burning up phone lines speaking with businesses, business leaders, CEOs, politicians.
She knows CEOs. Now we're getting somewhere.
And of course, you know, Canadian politicians and Unifor seem to have been quick to try and throw Mexico under the bus. You would think that if the United States is targeting Mexico and Canada, that Canada and Mexico would have good reason to make common cause. Whereas the impression seems to be, don't target us, target them. And I don't think that's particularly helpful.
Well, yes, and one asks the question, well, what was the free trade agreement about? If they can so quickly say, oh, let's have, I understand Ford's language, is he said that we should have Fortress AMCAN. Fortress AMCAN. That's us. That's the U.S. and Canada, and it'll be a fortress. And Mexico is disinvited by this guy who is the premier of Ontario.
And I haven't seen the leadership of my union anyway objecting to that approach. They seem to be adopting it. They certainly have adopted it in regards to China. It was not that long ago that the headline issue was tariffs against China. And the position of the Unifor leadership is that they would support any action that the Canadian government would take against China.
Any?
No qualifications. That was the word that Lana Payne used when she was speaking about what Canada should do in regards to tariffs against China. She said she would support any action that the Canadian government took.
Yeah. You know, you speak so much to some matters that need to be everybody to be reminded about.
It also highlights the importance of having a unified Canadian labor movement, and the fact that Unifor remains resistant to being part of that labor movement, has not rejoined the Canadian Labor Congress, is a big problem. It means that Canadian labor movement, from the outset, is deeply divided. And and I haven't seen any steps to repair that divide in light of their current crisis, which is clearly one of the first steps that needs to be taken.
You know, you could date the crisis in some ways. I know it's ancient history, ancient, long, long, long ago, when Justin Trudeau was a candidate and was elected the first time. Was it 2015? And he ran on saying that he was going to improve relations which had been damaged by Stephen Harper in his out of zealotry of and allegiance to American power. And Trudeau said, we're going to improve relations with China. We're going to improve relations with, I hate to say these names because it's so troubling to think about, the Islamic Republic, and with Syria and others, including Russia. This was 2015. And that melted in an early sun, early spring came and melted that away. It wasn't long before Justin Trudeau had an embarrassing moment where he visited China, and there was talk of, you know, this Pacific trade agreement, which they actually had been cobbled together, I believe, by Obama and others. But Trudeau went there thinking he could enter into a trade agreement with a rapidly developing nation and economy, which would offer great trade possibilities, and also it included such things as, you know, the Chinese company Huawei. That was all supposed to happen. But there was a photo at the end of these conversations where Trudeau was standing alone at a microphone, not with his Chinese counterpart, and basically saying, I guess this is not at the moment something we can do. We're going to have to continue to work on it. But my guess is that Washington phoned and said, wrap up your talks with the Chinese and come back here, because you're not going to do that. Because that was a rich possibility. I mean, China, as you know, we'll talk about it, but the auto business, Chinese are becoming the top country producing automobiles. And we've talked on this show, why can't we build their vehicles here? Or why can't they build their vehicles here? If Trump says he doesn't need us, why couldn't we? But anyway, that's to speak to how the decline of that possibility has brought us to this embarrassing point where Trudeau is now out the door and the premiers are all acting like they can do their own trade agreements, and they all pledge allegiance to the American fortress.
It's really important that we say that workers in Canada, the working class in Canada, has no interest in obeying these dictates from U.S. government and their military aggressiveness and imperialism around the world. And, you know, that seems to be what's happening, you know, that they are engaged in these aggressive, illegal actions in many countries around the world using their military. And we're expected to, just line up and support that and increase our military spending. And as workers, we should be fighting against that. We should be saying, why is Canada part of NATO when it's carrying out these kind of activities? That's no benefit to
and
us.
And it's expensive. Mexico doesn't have to give Donald Trump and NATO 2% of its budget.
Right, or more. Trump's saying more now.
He's moving the goalposts, by the way. Since Ford says, let's give them 2%, and Trump now says he wants 5%.
Five, yes.
That's exactly what Farley Moore was talking about.
Yeah, and here again, I have to remind people, this was what Lana Payne, the leader of Unifor, said in regards to defense spending and what the incoming Trump government wanted. She said to Unifor delegates, You can expect, though, that increased defense spending will be part of the Canada-U.S. negotiations that are going to take place and discussions. And if Canada is to meet the 2% target on defense spending, that will mean an additional $12 billion a year in procurement. Now, you can build a lot of capacity in our aerospace sector with $12 billion a year. And we've got a plan and we've got a policy. So we have to make sure that we are benefiting from whatever dollar is going to be spent federally and provincially in the days and months and years ahead. We're going to have to hold them accountable to make sure that Canadians benefit from that.
So, you know, again, probably one of the most memorable phrases that ever came out of the mouth of an American president, Dwight Eisenhower, as he was leaving office, he says, "Beware of the military-industrial complex." And it sounds like Lana Payne has a military-industrial complex.
Yes.
She wants to be part of that. And, you know, this is the old thing of forging chains that are going to be put on your own leg.
Yes.
But it is interesting. I mean, as far as I know, the Canadian Labour Congress has not declared itself on this matter. I don't know whether the Quebec labor movement has made any pronouncements. But I was certainly in a mode here where workers have a tendency to be so loyal to their own masters that they fight each other. And you made the point. I mean, the class interest of Canadian workers would be to say, you have a car maker, for example, that's from abroad that would like to come here, since Donald Trump doesn't want to be here. Why don't we ask them if they would build cars here?
And instead, we're beholden to largely U.S.-based corporations that operate here to make profits for themselves, but with no commitment to the best interests of Canadian workers or Canadian communities. And they leave when they want, or threaten when they want, or demand huge concessions and grants in the billions of dollars. But they make decisions on their own. No matter how much money they get from Canadian government, they still decide when and where they're going to operate.
Yeah. You know, again, it would be great if the international labor movement, and it does exist, there are headquarters of various people called, you know, the international unions and all that, to begin to comment on this question of changing sovereignty and say, for example, and nobody here, to my knowledge, other than talking about Canada, they don't say it is improper for you, the United States, to be talking about the eliminating the sovereignty of Panama. It's improper for you to be talking about how you will purchase Greenland, unlike Canada, which you can annex. International solidarity ought to have some substance. And so it's rather urgent. And we'll be following this down the line, because it's going to be the test of whether or not we operate from a class position or we operate from a corporate position in the labor movement.
From a class position, I think part of a working class approach to these issues and sovereignty would be saying that we have to nationalize these corporations that don't honor our interests, don't have our interests at heart, and use them for the benefit of Canadians. That should be part of our outlook. I want to remind people about what happened in France with Renault. I think it's just a wonderful example. After World War II, the government in France accused Louis Renault. It was a family-owned business for 80 years or something, auto production by Renault in France. They accused Renault of collaborating with the Germans. And he was arrested in 1944, September. And he had that company had ruthlessly repressed strikers in the 1930s, and Renault's harsh handling of those strikes, 1936 to 1938, left him without political allies, and so nobody came to his aid. He was incarcerated in prison, and he died in prison in October of 1944 while awaiting trial, and afterwards de Gaulle posthumously expropriated the company from Louis Renault without compensation and permanently. Mm-hmm. And courts in France, even in 1945 and again in 1961, upheld that expropriation.
Yeah. A nice story. And it's again, it goes to the, who runs the country. It has to be run in the interest and name of the people. And when companies decide that they don't have to be patriotic, they can do as they please, they should run into the concept of we're all created equal. We have one person, one vote. We will determine what is best for our country. Not like Renault or Ford Motor. By the way, good old, you could, I'm sure you've made a good case for arresting Henry Ford, actually, or the Ford family, because they were supplying, of course, weapons, machinery, but also flat-out anti-Semitism from Henry himself.
And direct contact with Hitler and his government.
Yeah.
In 1938, just the year before the outbreak of World War II, Hitler sent emissaries to the United States to drape Henry Ford with a big sash and you know, award the Grand Cross of the German Eagle. And Henry Ford, you can see the pictures of him standing there, pleased as punch with this Nazi regalia on.
By the way, we were speaking to Tony Lea, is the author of The Truth about the 37 strike at General Motors Oshawa. And Tony, you've been speaking all, getting good reception, and you have many places you're going to be coming, and people are going to be hearing you talk about this book. I hope everybody gets a copy of it. It's Baraka Books. Just closing, Tony, you looked into some information on what was going on in Los Angeles from the point of view of some of the strange conduct of the government. They're using prisoners to fight the fire. Talk about that.
Yeah, this is something that occurs across the United States, but it's particularly striking in the situation in L.A. right now. There's over 1,000 incarcerated prisoners who are acting as firefighters, fighting those blazes in L.A. right now. Apparently, their pay scale was increased in 2023, and they now receive between 16 cents to 74 cents an hour, or a maximum day rate of $5.08 to $10.24. They're out doing the most dangerous.
Absolutely dangerous.
Their injury rates are higher than four times higher than other firefighters. They work the longest hours. They get a daily food budget for lunch of $4 per day. So they typically get two pieces of white bread with bologna for lunch.
I'm glad they used bologna. It kind of sums it up.
Yeah. The other side of the story, which is also striking, is the number of firefighters who are private corporations, who are hired by the billionaires to protect their homes, their mansions, and their businesses. So that's also going on at the same time.
Privatization of fighting a fire.
I saw an interview with one guy who owns a little shopping center right beside the Palisades fire, and everything around it is burnt to the ground, and his shopping center is untouched, and his privately contracted fire fighters are there protecting it.
It's just, it's really incredible. It's interesting that that there people are calling on Wayne Gretzky to lead us against Trump. And he has the last. I visited a lawyer in a gated community, and there was a hilltop with a mansion, and the lawyer said to me, "That's Gretzky's place." I've always thought that I don't mind a gated community. I just think they ought to be locked on the outside. Mm-hmm. Let me, and there's one other thing. I guess people could go to this. It's a Twitter account. It's Amazon Teamsters. And people, yes. I would say, should check that out. There, I read a woman who said that she had been delivering at 8:30 at night in a place where buildings were burning, and the company had her delivering, and the air was bad. She's very simple. They say they only care about their profits, and they don't care about our safety, right?
That's Amazon, and their billionaire owner, of course, and many Amazon workers are now joining with the Teamsters Union.
Yep,
and taking that on, and that's absolutely what's
that's
needed.
A good story.
Yes.
Well, Tony Leo, thanks very much. This is the Tata Report, and we see you next week.